friends, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Chris Grant, and today I am delighted to be joined by a digital construction legend, Dave Shepherd. Dave Shepherd's going to tell us all about the Houses of Parliament project and how specifically digital construction is related to it and how it's playing a key role in the whole project. And we're just going to go on and talk about more digitalisation in general. So, Dave, delighted to have you on. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, I'm really glad to be here. I almost looked around behind myself to kind of work out who this person was. I wasn't sure he was speaking about me, but it's very flattering for you to say that. And hopefully, you know, we can have a really good conversation about, you know, something that I really love and really, you know, get the chance to do something that I've always been very passionate about.
Well, Dave, you're the right man for this, a very special edition of the podcast. I'm just delighted to have you on. So, Dave, just let's get straight into it then. To begin with, can you tell us about your digitalization journey? You know, how did you end up playing such a key role in such a landmark project?
Well, you know, it's the story of maybe, I don't want to go back too far because I'm 61, so I kind of have to give a very potted history of that. And one of the things that happened as a result of after coming out of university is that, you know, I really plonked down a lot of money and bought a personal computer. And at the time, I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it, but I felt it was the future. I was going to be ahead of the game and so on. And it actually served me quite well because I did a higher national certificate in construction management. And whilst I was doing that course, we learned about software tools like AutoCAD. And strangely enough, at the end of that course, I got the opportunity to work with the training center that delivered the course. And they asked me to come on as a technical trainer. And pretty much from there, eventually went into industry and started to work with the likes of HOK, which is probably one of the most forward-looking practices when it comes to digital construction and the use of IT to improve outcomes in the building industry. Also worked for Lendlease for a while, and also worked for the software developer known as Autodesk that is probably the foremost vendor in that field. So it's kind of evolved from there. And during that time, when back in 2015, I worked on the independent options appraisal for the restoration and renewal of the Palace of Westminster. So this was just looking at different scenarios as to how this could be constructed and how BIM could be used, building information management, some people call it, could be used to facilitate the delivery of that. And it's really spun out of that. That opportunity revisited itself when this job that I'm in came up, which was digital product manager for restoration renewal. And by that time, it was a balance of the background of having worked on this, but also my engagement with software development. And there's a whole journey of, shall we say, third age studying that I did.
Brilliant. Digital product manager. What does that mean? What does that role involve?
Yeah, I mean, it's really about putting together the mix of software tools that give us a clearer picture of not only what we're going to construct, but how quickly we can construct it. You can simulate everything from the cost to the different types of service routes, vehicle routes. All of those things can be simulated. Most of us engage with this on a you know, individual level. We've all watched programs like Grand Designs, where we start to see the makeover before our very eyes, before the actual build goes on. And it's very much using those kinds of tools to help people to, I suppose the best way to put it, to see the future and then be able to make good decisions about how they could change things in order to get a better future. Yeah.
So Dave, maybe give us a bit of an overview of the project. You know, maybe give us a sense of the scale and size of this project. And of course, it's a lot more complex than maybe Grand Designs. But maybe tell us what the purpose and the scope of the project is.
Yeah, I think for the Palace of Westminster, if you think about it, obviously it's an iconic site. I think probably more iconic than even landmarks, say in France, like Notre Dame Cathedral and so on. And you're talking about a building that contains 1,100 rooms. You've got 100 staircases. You've got 3 kilometers of passageways. The, you know, 3,400 windows, 80 kilometers of telephone cables. Essentially, you could actually fit 4.5 Wembley pitches into,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
It's staggering in terms of the scale of the building. And one of the challenges that we have is that it desperately needs refurbishment. And this isn't just cosmetic. We're talking about things like fire safety. We're talking things like the presence of asbestos. At one time, it was seen as this wonder material. Now we know better. And it cannot be that you can do a renovation without, you know, remediating asbestos and so on. So there are complexities to it. Probably the other part is that in the basement, there are lots of services which have, in a sense, been shunted alongside other services which essentially could not be removed. So this offers the opportunity to remove and then, you know, renew those services and rationalize them. So okay. That they deliver the house that we need, yeah.
Right, and in terms of maybe just the actual, you know, construction and maybe consultants, what many contractors would be involved with the project, or maybe how many people? I'm not sure how you quantify that, but just if you can give us a wee bit of sense of that as well, that would be useful.
Yeah, it's difficult to put, you know, actual numbers on it. I would say, and I think this is pertinent to what we're talking about now, is that from a sustainability perspective, mm-hmm. it's very important that we pursue a policy of diversity. And when I say diversity, in terms of the scale of companies that are involved, I mean, some of the specialist trades that need to be involved in these, if you think about the kinds of, you know, what we call encaustic tiles, which are used, and even, you know, the very fabric, you've got stonemasons who are going to have to look at the fabric of the exterior and begin to work on that. And part of the policy is to ensure that there is as wide a spread, and I mean this in terms of geographical spread, mm-hmm. Across the country, of people involved in this, because it's a national building. It's, you know, it can't be confining, you know, the delivery of that building to a particular locality, because it belongs to all of us. Yeah,
sure.
And
sure.
And so, and that means that SMEs definitely will be involved in the delivery of this program. Yeah.
And so what stage are you at just now, Dave?
So we're in scheme design stage, which most people know as stage two. Mm-hmm. Essentially what we're doing at this stage is conducting and fast-tracking a series of surveys to ensure that we have a clear picture of the challenges involved in bringing this building, you know, and looking after this building in the 21st century and beyond. So a lot of it is doing that survey work, being able to integrate that survey work so that people can actually make really good decisions with all the information that they need and in one place. And I think that that's part, the critical part of my role is ensuring that information relating to safety, cost, quality, delivery approach, that when somebody is looking at essentially a virtual replica of the building, all of that information is easily accessible and can be called up, you know, within a matter of seconds. And to do that, you need digital tools. And that's what we're trying to do, is to give a person an environment, give the people involved and the decision makers an environment where all of that information is layered in such a way that it's easy to make really good decisions about how this, you know, massive project, I'd say program, sure. should be approached.
Sure. And I guess you maybe even answered this question already, but what role then, I mean, it sounds like you've described it already, but what role does digitalization play and how significant is this?
Yeah, I think I can break it down a bit more, because I mean, there are probably, I would say, there are about, I'd say there are five key things that we're trying to do. I know you're supposed to say three, but I'll say five. So okay. The first one is that what we're trying to do is to reduce what I call transaction costs. Mm-hmm. And that means that when you're sharing information, instead of it staying in your email system and then you're searching through that and somebody else is searching through their own email system, if we can centralize all of that information in what we call a common data environment, then you've got a good audit trail. Everybody knows the status of the project. They can find the information they're looking for. They're not calling up somebody and say, do you have that email that you sent me 3 weeks ago or something like that? It's all centralized. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that it allows us to, as I said a little bit earlier, add to this virtual replica, this 3D environment that represents, you get a visual of the Palace of Westminster. You can then add these layers of information that can be called up around cost, quality, schedule, all of those other things. Mm-hmm. The other one that I think is quite important is that at the end of this, or even during this program, this kind of information, for instance, as we have heritage discoveries, some people will remember that a few weeks ago, a medieval wall was discovered, and it may have historical importance and so on. But that kind of information would be useful to the wider parliament. So while the restoration renewal is benefiting from that, being able to pass that information on to people in Parliament in a way that they can use for managing the assets and those types of things, that's probably a crucial one. In fact, I will stick to three and say that those are the three key things that we're really focusing on right now.
Right, okay. Well, that's probably quite a lot to go at then. Anyway, yeah. You know, even just talking about the digital tools, you know, which we're going to come on to next. What are the range of digital tools then and the technology that's been utilised in the project? And then what do they do, Dave? And can you give us a couple of examples just to put that into a bit, some sort of context for us?
So one example of that, and as I said, I would not mention specific products, but one example of that is that if somebody's doing a survey of a room, they're picking up, for instance, different things like heritage items. They may be picking up the presence of asbestos, and therefore there's a specific treatment that's needed. Or they might want to simply identify the condition, for instance, of windows, and might have a scale of, I don't know, 1 to 5 to define what that is. Now, if each one of those people is doing that on a piece of paper, can you imagine the task of somebody going through stacks and stacks of these bits of paper and then trying to come up with a figure for the overall cost of doing these things? Whereas if you have a database, so that's the crucial thing, and that database is, you know, let's say the header for each page of that database is room 106, room 107, and then all the information that's associated with that room that we've just described is being tabulated in there. Then as soon as I search for that particular room, I can see all that information. So that's one piece of it. Mm-hmm. The other piece of it is, but what if I have to do a risk assessment? Now, what if that window is at height? So it's working at height. So I'm probably in the risk assessment and have to think now in terms of some sort of platform, all of those types of things. So if I can integrate all of that information that I've just described into a 3D environment, it means I can actually realize that that window is, I don't know, 4 meters up, and it's probably going to need a specific type of access. There's going to have to be some sort of fall arrest system. All of those types of things that you can do because visually you're understanding exactly what's involved with that. If you're just looking at essentially some text on a screen, it doesn't really give you a context for what's going on. So that's the second really important part of it. And then obviously what I consider to be the third important part of it is about project communication. As I said, the idea that, for instance, if there's a request for information, that it's not just a bunch of emails that have been flying around, but they're all brought together. So each RFI has an index number against it. Yeah. Uh-huh. And it means that I can simply type in the index number or type in maybe a bit of the name of the RFI, what it's about, and it immediately comes up on screen and I can choose the one I want and see the whole history of that whole RFI through to closure. So it's those kinds of things that you can really do with digital tools, which will make a big difference. And maybe I'll just really mention that one of the reasons why I think it's so important is because past experiences that we've seen with the Grenfell tragedy, and the fact that those types of tools could have made a big difference in terms of, for instance, specifying the cladding and knowing who did what and when. I mean, those are the kinds of things that also, to me, it's not just about the fact that we can do things so much faster, but I think it's also about the fact that we can do things so much more safely as well. Yeah.
And transparently, Dave, as well, I think, which is, absolutely. Yeah. No, here, absolutely. No, and I think that's the thing that's really exciting for me is it feels like, you know, we're getting to this golden thread. I know it's a bit of a buzzword, but it's a really important concept to everyone needs to grasp, whether you're the guy, the sparky work on the ground, or, you know, whoever's procuring the work. So, no, that's fantastic. Now, Dave, I know you're probably maybe at the design and kind of collate all this, you know, making an information project plan or whatever, I don't know what you would call it, but you know, at the minute you must have contractors on the project just doing bits of work. So, you know, are contractors engaging with the digital tools in the project at the moment? You know, and is there a difference between the levels of capabilities from the tier ones down to the smaller guys and how they engage with the tools?
I think one of the challenges that we have is that very often the starting point, because of the efficiency of it, yes, there are SME criteria that tier ones have to address so that they do have a good proportion of SMEs engaged in the project and so on. So that is being addressed. But at the same time, simply for efficiency's sake, yes, a lot of times we're dealing with tier ones. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest challenge that's faced is that very often as you go further and further through this supply chain to, you know, the tier threes and tier fours, you realize that the access to those digital tools, just for capturing things like, for instance, imagine an electrical engineer, he's, you know, maybe got three or four staff working with him on site, or somebody who's installing, I don't know, photovoltaics, for instance, and so on. But they just won't necessarily have the kind of sophisticated tools to capture the commissioning information. Again, what can happen is that the person might resort to using, let's say, just Word, filling in the information when they get back to the office, and then sending a PDF. The challenge with that is that once it's moved into that static format of a PDF, trying to extract the pieces of information, like, for instance, the warranty details, the serial number, the SFG20 code, it just suddenly becomes really, really difficult. So one of the journeys I've been on, and we'll probably talk about this a bit later, but has been to develop apps which allow people to plug in the information, but because each piece of information has its own place in an overall table, we can then extract that information and transfer it, for instance, into CAFM, so that those who are working in operations and maintenance can actually see those codes. They don't have to be sort of copying and pasting them and having to type that stuff in. And it's those, you know, those little gains. And I suppose that's one of the things that I think is important in the context of what we're talking about. It's those small gains, incremental gains, that very often all together add up to an overall more efficient business. And I think very often people are thinking, I've got to make some sort of big leap. You know, I try to keep things quite tight. I'm not buying loads and loads of fixed assets because that's just not the way my business works. I'm on tight margins. Where am I going to get the money to do these major things? And I think it's not always about doing something big. It's about doing something incremental that will make a difference. Yeah.
Sure, Dave. I mean, I'm still astounded that, you know, even just, you know, you know, just the fact that people still type lots of stuff into Word documents, and they're wasting so much data that they could actually be using it for you know, because if it's a usable format, as like you described there, you can start to really, really get the benefit from that. And yeah, as industry whole, as a whole, doesn't seem to have switched on to that yet, Dave. I know maybe you and your role, but what do you think? What's your thoughts on that?
I think this still comes back to the simple reality that it's a low margin business for a lot of people. But, you know, I mean, probably more so now. But, you know, a few years ago, it was 3-4% and so on. And the way that the construction industry worked is that you kept your asset base low. So you were hiring equipment in, but you weren't necessarily owning those assets and so on. And so any time that somebody talks about, you know, forking out money for tech, you know, people start to get a little bit antsy because they're thinking, well, you know, that's going to hit my bottom line. What about if there's a downturn? Am I still carrying those assets and paying for them? It's all of that sort of stuff. So I can absolutely understand where people can start small. But starting small is simply about finding tools that, for instance, reduce the admin overhead. So let's look at a simple one, site diaries. Why do you have to keep them? Well, because you know that in the event of having to make a claim, you need to have all the evidence that's there, that, I don't know, the conditions on site made it impossible for you to do the concrete pour, or that if, say, there is an incident, like a safety incident, that it was processed properly and so on. Just using digitals to do that, rather than sitting there and scribbling on a piece of paper and say, oh, I'll remember when I go back home, I'll type that into the computer when I get back. Something as basic as that will make a big difference. And you don't, you know, the benefit is going to be downstream when you are putting in a claim because, you know, due to lost time or something like that. And being able to say, look, I've got all the information here. Now, I know that there's a bit of inertia, you know, some of it's due to, you know, people are just maybe stuck in their ways. They've been doing things a particular way for many years. You don't have to necessarily take on staff to do that. You just need to be working with a tech partner who is going to do the handholding and isn't going to charge you an arm and a leg for you to adopt those very simple things. For me, at 60, which was last year, but at the age of 60, I got into, and again, I've got a bit of an IT background, but I started to develop some apps on SharePoint.
Yeah.
And as you know, and some of them were very, very basic, you know, things like just being able to assess work that people are doing on different sites. So they just, you know, putting in the information about work that is completed, doing some snagging, you know, it's just basic stuff like that. But it gets, you know, your feet in the water so that you can start to do bigger things later. And I think the other piece of it is just having a longer term plan. So you're going to plan this over, I don't know, a 5-year period. You're not going to be doing all of the fancy tech, you know, within a year's time. It's just about having a nicely paced introduction to it. Find out what other people are doing and then say, well, okay, who did you work with? Were they, you know, were they patient in working with you, or were they just trying to essentially make a sale? And once you've found that particular partner, then it's going to be useful to stick with them because they're the ones who are going to look after you and make sure that you get the outcomes that you're looking for, yeah?
Sure, sure. Well, maybe, I mean, have you implemented any of this kind of thing on the end of the projects just now, Dave? I mean, are you using basic tools like that for, you know, the project that you're involved with, or is it similar, what have you got?
It's very early in the life cycle of this. What I can say is that, and maybe that I can speak to this in terms of, you know, the previous work that I did. So yes, I worked for Autodesk for 11 and a half years. Autodesk is one of the largest vendors of this, you know, 3D mixed with data sort of environment that's used for the construction industry and so on. And in some cases, yes, we were working with these, you know, big contractors and so on. But in a lot of cases, we were working with some of the smaller ones who, as I said, they simply wanted to, for instance, get some consistency across all of their sites. So, for instance, if they were commissioning an air handling unit, they were going through the same steps regardless of what site that they were working on. Mm-hmm. And so they could know that they were getting consistent quality of their staff and so on. And I find it curious because, you know, if we were looking at, let's say we've got a fleet of vans that we use on different sites and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. you wouldn't want to think that when you brought it in for a service, that somebody would work, go through maybe six of the items that on the other site or for the other yeah. service. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and yet when we do it, it's like, oh yeah, he knows his stuff. He'll just make sure it. And it's just having consistent checklists so that you know that everybody is going through the same steps and they're checking the same information and those types of things. So those are some of the really easy wins that people can have by using digital technology in the construction industry. And some of these tools, I mean, you know, if you go online and, you know, you find that they're really cheap. I mean, we're talking about something like, you know, people spending about, you know, £6 or £7 a month for a tool that does, you know, basic snagging and that sort of thing. Is it really that difficult? You know, probably quite user-friendly. It works on their phone. And it's those kinds of things that people need to do as their first steps. You know, the old saying that you need to, you know, walk before you run is probably quite appropriate, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. In terms of the project, your current project, then, you know, and I guess you're saying, I'm caveat by saying it's early days yet. Maybe it's like, can you just give us a picture of what the digital construction team looks like or will look like on the project? You know, will it be a huge team? And you know, what are the key skills and the competencies and experiences that they have or will need? You know, and how have they had to learn the new skills along the way? And Dave, what about the skills yourself? What have you had to learn along the way? What new skills have you learned?
So I think there's a couple of things which we can unpack with that. One of them is that how I see the future is that what we call digital construction, you know, specialists, I think that it's actually going to merge into what construction people do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's if you think about the tech that is used in, you know, pretty much all over the place. Let's say people use things like, for instance, we have a call over Zoom or over Teams. Now, maybe at one time, because it was so new, people employed a Zoom specialist or a Teams specialist.
Yeah.
Now it's probably become so user-friendly that people really don't need that. And I'm hoping that digital construction is going to be the same thing, especially for the program. It doesn't mean that there isn't a set of skills to learn, but that's the first thing. I think the starting point for this has to be what you want to get out of the system. Yeah. So one of the things that everybody needs to be tuned into, I believe, is understanding from a data perspective what good looks like. For instance, let's look at something like snagging. If we are saying, let's say the turnaround time for closing a snag, it's just been identified clock of works or whatever, and the turnaround time for that, we're targeting an outcome and saying we want to know that on average all snags are closed within, I don't know, 2 days. Okay, let's work with that. So once you've agreed on that objective, now you need to see if the numbers stack up. So you've got a system that whenever a snag is identified, it's assigned, and that person then has to work on the snag. It's collecting that information that says it started on this date, it closed on such and such a date, and then across all of those different issues, what's the average? And it's as simple as that. It's being able to understand and interpret the data that says, you know, right now it's taking 3 days to close a snag. Not good enough. What do we need to do to change our behaviors? What do we need to do to sift through these issues and maybe push back those which aren't really proper snags in order to get the outcome that we want? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the kind of mindset where you are data driven but not for its own sake. You're data-driven because those numbers actually tell you about performance. And it's that mindset that's probably more critical. Once you've got that mindset, then you start to say, well, what are the tools and the processes that I need to do that? And I think this takes me to the other skill, and it's certainly something that I've had to get to grips with, which is the interchanges of information between different people in order to get the end result. Let's suppose, just very quickly, that you're trying to collect comprehensive asset information at handover. So let's say you give somebody a handheld tool, and as they're doing the commissioning, they can put in the manufacturer, the serial number, the SFG20 number for maintenance, and the warranty information. Okay, mm-hmm. So probably you need some sort of dashboard that tells you whether people are doing what they should be doing. Are they leaving out bits of data like the serial numbers because somebody just said, it's too much like hard work? I don't know if that's the case, but I'm just saying that might be the case. You needed some sort of dashboard to collect that information. But at the same time, what you're also needing to do is to ensure that when that information is passed to the next person who has to work with it, that they have everything they need to move it on. So it's almost like a relay race. And the issue with that is that, as you know, the fact that you've got a sprinter on the relay team who, like, you know, a Usain Bolt, doesn't mean you're going to win the relay race. And, you know, there's a great saying, a chain is as strong as its weakest link. So very often, it's understanding where those weak links are. You know, is it that somebody, for instance, is printing something out and then filling it in by hand and then giving that to somebody else to input the data into the system? That's just wasting time. Why aren't they just using some sort of digital method to fill in the information that they need and then to pass it on? So those are the kinds of things that I think have been part of my journey of understanding all of those different pieces of the puzzle and understanding that you need somebody who is almost like a coach for the relay team. Mm-hmm. If you're in the relay, all you're thinking about is your part of the race. You're not thinking about the entirety of the race. And so you need somebody who understands the handovers and understands that in order to finish the race fast, those handovers have to be as efficient as possible. I think that relay analogy is really, you know, quite key in terms of getting the benefits of digital construction. Yeah.
Yeah, and I take it that'll be a challenge as well, particularly around like the size. They need to try to scale that as well. Must be a challenge.
It is. I mean, some of it, as I said, in terms of the scale of information, if you're trying to collect information on 1,100 rooms and all of those different, you know, dimensions from safety, you know, presence of asbestos, heritage collections, how we're going to decant that area so that people can obviously work on it, on all of those types of things, then it's massive amounts of information. But what you try to do is to begin with almost a template of what that looks like. So you might start out with something like a room data sheet that simply says, these are all the things that we need to collect. And we're going to build essentially a form that sits on your phone, and these things are going to be collected, and actually we're going to have a dashboard so that if somebody isn't collecting that information, then we will know and we'll be able to say, you know, you need to do your part as much as everybody else needs to do, so on. So a lot of times having digital power tools makes this job a lot easier. And as long as people are using those types of power tools, then very often you can do an awful lot. And very often, it's not always a case of having perfect. It's just having good enough.
Yes. Yes.
You know, getting to perfection is not always going to be possible. But good enough to make an informed decision is what we're trying to do.
Yeah. And I guess you're iterating. You're looking for the perfect system. You're going to iterate. You're going to improve. That's the whole idea of it, I guess, Dave. And then, so that sounds like one of the key benefits, you know, of digitalization on the project. So, you know, can you maybe give us some examples of the benefits that have been realized or you maybe anticipate in the future?
So I think one of them, as I said, one of the key benefits is that, and I suppose I'll use an example that we know from the past, which is, you know, Elizabeth Tower, Big Ben, and so on. And I think we're all impressed with the end result of it. I think there's been great feedback in terms of what the end result was. But one of the challenges in delivering that was that, you know, the saying goes, you don't know what you don't know. And essentially, it was only after they started to get into, you know, the meat of that project, they suddenly realized that there were lots more things to fix. It's very much like when, you know, your mechanic has to do a major repair and he says, well, I'm going to have to lift out the engine and see what else is going on under there. And then suddenly, you know, you get that sharp intake of breath and, you know, the head shaking. And you know that there's other stuff that they found that is even more, challenging. So the point I'm making is that in that sort of context, what you want to know, what you could have done with knowing beforehand, is as much as possible about the condition.
Yeah.
And if you could get that sort of information, you could have greater certainty on cost, couldn't you?
Sure.
You wouldn't suddenly see this jump in cost because suddenly they've discovered something that they didn't know before. That's probably going to be the most important one. If you're having to essentially put this before Parliament and say, this is the kind of funding that's needing, what you don't want to have sudden surprises where what you thought was an agreed, shall we say, cap on the cost is now being exceeded because there's other stuff that needs doing. So I think that's going to be one of the first ways in which that's going to be realized. I think the other one is stakeholder engagement. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I know that this is an experience that a lot of people have where, you know, builders are talking to each other and you say, well, what we should probably do if we take it up, you know, up through to the third floor, they just go through the ceiling. No, yeah, on the left-hand side, yes, go through the ceiling and then we'll come down, yeah, the other lift shaft. Then I'm sure this is going to work. And whoever's involved in this, you know, the lay people who are involved in this, they're completely blind. They you know, it just doesn't register for them. And when they can see that in a 3D picture, it just immediately makes sense to them. When they see maybe the extent of, let's say, asbestos, it's one thing to just say, oh, yes, we found it in lots and lots of rooms. But when it's highlighted in a context that they can understand, then people say, okay, I can understand why it's going to cost that much to remediate. And it's those kinds of engagements with lay people. Otherwise, those numbers will just not make sense to them. And they're likely to, you know, have a negative reaction to those numbers because they just don't associate it with what they think. Once you give people some sort of 3D picture of it, they suddenly think, oh, okay, I understand what you're talking about.
Sure.
So it's those kinds of things that's probably the key benefits, yeah?
Yes. No, and I think that there's two ends of that spectrum, certainly in my experience, Dave, is that, you know, you're right about lay people, you know, bringing, you know, a flat 2D draw, 2D image to life really helps even, you know, construction teams to explain and actually maybe even come up with a better solution sometimes, you know. Mm. And then equally on the opposite side, when you're saying, how much is it going to cost me? And as you say, if you've got a visual representation rather than try to dig through spreadsheets, really, that visualization really, really helps things. Yeah. I mean, that must be a key benefit, you know, because particularly, I mean, I'd imagine it would be challenging on a project like of that size to, you know, you've got to obviously have a lot of scrutiny, I guess, without getting into any details around the contracts, but really just to, it must at least help make the business case, you know, if you're trying to explain a complex scenario to people who are maybe not technical or just financial or just, you know, interested in a little piece of their jigsaw. So, yeah.
Yeah, it certainly does. And especially if you're having to go through a wider range of those different, you know, design options. What people are trying to work out is, what's the difference between these two, and how does that relate to the cost that's associated with those options? Because if they don't understand that, and there's a difference of, you know, millions, then they're not quite sure why they're choosing one apart from the other, apart from the fact that it looks like it costs less. And of course, the worst part of this is when, okay, they go for the lower cost option, and then somewhere down the line, somebody says, oh, but didn't you realize that, you know, it was in the plan, you know, it's in the plan that it means now that you're going to have to trek from this place to this place with all the disruption. But you did agree to the plan, and the person is just shaking their heads and saying, I didn't agree to any such thing. I didn't see that on the plan. And I think this is where what we call 4D comes in, because very often, even if you're looking in something in 3D or in a drawing, very often people are trying to put as much information on that as possible. And it's not being sort of added over a time period. So, for instance, oh, we have to demolish this bit first, or we're going to have to decant these people over to here. They're going to be there for the next, I don't know, 2 years, whilst we're going to work on this part. Then this is going to happen, then that is going to happen. And somebody tries to put it all onto one plan. Whereas when you use what we call 4D, where time is the extra dimension, then what you're getting is this kind of time-lapse picture that shows over time. You'll see a little timeline at the bottom showing, you know, maybe the month and year. And as that goes through, you're seeing the changes which are happening over time. You can actually stop at a particular point and then start to discuss. So you're saying, this is what it's going to be like in 2029, or this is what it's going to be like in 2032. Incredibly powerful. One thing I've probably thrown as a sort of caveat, which is that there is work involved. You know, it's not like the stuff of sort of the Hollywood movies where people can just say to the computer to do something and miraculously it appears on the screen and so on. And I think for a lot of people, their experience, their background experience, and this is probably what makes them shy away. Certainly that's the case with my wife, is that, you know, one bad experience of working with tech and being frustrated with it is all people, you know, and then the minute that it's put in front of them, they just think, you know, I'm either going to be spending an awful lot of money or I'm going to be spending an awful lot of time just trying to get this sorted and so on. And I think that that's one of the reasons why very often people, they shy away from introducing technology and so on. What the way to probably address that is to actually know your limitations and then to explain to the person who you're working with, you know, if it's a software partner and so on, this is the pace that you are comfortable with. There's no sense people trying to throw technology at you that you just can't handle as yet. So it's always helpful to have somebody who can partner with you, or somebody who's separate from the vendor. I mean, the work that you guys do in terms of digital construction means that there's somebody who actually understands the challenges that lay people who aren't particularly IT literate go through, and in a way that they're not constantly being pressured because somebody's actually just trying to make a sale. So I think having somebody who's a buffer like yourselves is probably a good way to do that.
You're right, Dave. And also, I feel that the tech should be designed to suit your needs, if you like. And I think probably the evolution of technology has been that there's been big platforms, and it's came from the concept of the architects and et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it's now going the other way a little bit. And you know, with some of these little the no code apps, or whatever you want to call them, or the power apps and stuff like that, you can get these created the way that you want. You just you tell you if you can explain to someone how your business works, That's that, you know, and that's kind of getting to more of the bespoke tailored side of things.
Yeah.
You know, and well, you know, yourselves, Dave, the key lessons, you know, in the context of digitalization that maybe you can share with us that might be more useful for the wider industry that to know about.
Yeah, I think the first lesson is focus on tools that allow you to claw back time. I mean, it's not only good from a standpoint of the efficiency of your business. And claw back time, I'm talking about admin. We all kind of hate it, you know, filling in site diaries, tracking issues, those kinds of things. Find tools, and the tool that works for you might not work for somebody else.
Yeah.
So it's finding something for your business that can capture that sort of information and lower that admin overhead. Once you've lowered the admin overhead, then you can spend a bit more time in your toolbox talks. And whether that those talks around safety, whether that's around planning, but it's being able to catch up. And again, I'm going to have to say this around, you know, the mental health. I mean, you know, we know the stats in terms of the suicide rate and it's in terms of the incidence of fatalities on construction sites.
Mm-hmm.
Your priority is to claw back time by just using more efficient tools to do your admin and not find that you are going from a long day on site to sitting in an office somewhere typing up reports because you just don't have enough time to do it on site. Get something that's just going to make life a little bit easier for you to capture that information. You take a photo, fill in a few details, and now that's in your system. And being able to do that will then buy you the time to breathe and to learn the more complex things. That, to me, is the way that you kind of build these out. And in most cases, starting to organize the work of other people through checklists is going to be an efficiency. So being able to set up, you know, you've got something called Microsoft Forms, you can do those types of things. And maybe the last one is, you know, put your hand up when you need help. You know, rather than sit there struggling with something or just giving up in despair, it probably does make sense to put your hand up when you need some help and so on. So those would probably be the key tips, yeah?
Brilliant, Dave. Brilliant. No, I would say, I know you were involved with a big panel discussion recently at London Build, and mm-hmm. I just thought it would be important to bring it up today. Do you want to tell us about that and what you were talking about?
So the subject, and this was, you know, at London Build, of this panel discussion, was the digitalization of the golden thread. For those who aren't aware, the Building Safety Act has identified that a certain set of fire safety information needs to be developed, looked after, and maintained throughout the life cycle of the building, from one owner to the next owner, through different construction projects and so on. And that's why it's called a thread. It has to have that continuity to it. But they want this to be held in a digital form because then it can be searched. Then that sort of information can be scrutinized. And part of that scrutiny is the introduction of a series of gateways during the delivery of that project. I won't go into more detail than that. But the discussion really ensued around that. One of the key aspects of it was that some statements have been made by prominent individuals that say that essentially we don't have to be too detailed and specific. I think the phrasing went that one company's golden thread is going to differ from another company's golden thread. Immediately you say that, there's a discontinuity. Because what's going to happen is that when the time comes, for instance, there's a new owner and that information has to be handed over. What's the guarantee that the previous owner's set of information is going to be compatible with the new system? I mean, this is just basic stuff and so on. And so a lot of the discussion from my standpoint was teasing out those challenges and actually saying to people, it's not good enough for each person to have their own golden thread, because then the continuity of the thread is going to be disrupted. So it's basic things like that. And the rub is that it was the lack of a golden thread on Grenfell. There was no clear continuity between, for instance, the fire safety tests that were done on the particular type of cladding involved, Rainerbond PE.
Yep.
There's no continuity between that and the product selection that was made, because the product selection prioritized the thermal properties, but not the fire safety properties. And what we want is obviously a body of information about that product, which is comprehensive enough for people to make the right decision and not simply say, well, I was only looking at it from a standpoint of, you know, approved document L. And then somebody else is saying, I'm looking at, oh, well, I never really looked at it from a standpoint of approved document B. That,
sure,
you know, that's a thing of the past. And essentially, if you don't maintain that thread of information for the high-risk buildings, then essentially it's now, you know, it's been criminalized.
Yes.
So we need to really take this seriously. And I think it's, for me, where information management and data can get very, very serious, because it's so essential. And not just for the sake of the technical people involved, for the sake of also the residents to know that they are living in a safe building. Yeah.
Yeah. And are we getting near that consistency, Dave? I mean, or as it stands,
what we have in the form of a standard for this data, you know, I've gone on record in different construction publications that it's not fit for purpose, that the way it's presented, there is too much room for inconsistency. And that's really where the issue is. There's too much room for inconsistency. I don't think that you have to spend an, you know, awful lot of money in order to do those things and to be able to deliver that golden thread. But I think very often, you know, and they're missing the focus of this, is to identify specific types of information and then to organize it. One of the things that I did, by the way, is to build a power app. Again, this is something that runs on SharePoint, but actually does maintain all of those pieces of information that have been identified as required. But I've done it on SharePoint, and I think the price point compared to some of the proprietary stuff is significantly lower. What we do need is, I suppose I call it a coalition of the willing, where enough people get together and just simply say, you know what, we may not have a de jure standard, but we are going to develop a de facto standard. To all intents and purposes, this is how we're going to deliver the golden thread, and we are going to agree that we will be consistent across all of our organizations in delivering it in this way. And we're going to show it's possible as you know, it's transferred between different owners, that it maintains that continuity. If I think it's time that we kind of took it out of the sort of techie realm, and that essentially people got together and did something practical and said, let's just do this. Let's just do what we need to do to make it work. Let's test it. Let's challenge it. But at the end of it, I think this is going to have to be an industry initiative rather than something that kind of flows from, you know, the development of a standard into industry practice.
Yes. Okay. So, and I mean, when you look at some industries like the airline industry and manufacturing industries, and obviously BIM and digitalizations came a lot from that. But that has been done in other industries. You know, and I know maybe it's. As a particular challenges around construction that are, you know, I know it's not dead. You just can't just say, okay, they've done it over there. We just do it, replicate what they did. Because obviously we've got a slightly different culture and a different kind of way it's been made up. But But there must be some things that, that can be transferred across, is there?
So let's look at manufacturing, right? If I'm a steel or aluminium manufacturer, and Coca-Cola comes to me and says, you know, we've done some industry research, and the cans that you have been sending us, we actually need you to increase the width of them by, I don't know, 6 millimeters. Mm. You think for 1 minute that I'm going to say to them, you know what? I'm going to stick with the same size. It's not going to happen, because the control of that supply chain, the relative power of the top of that, the buyer at the top of that supply chain, is such that I'm going to be stupid to say no when I really don't have that many options to go elsewhere.
Yeah.
Contrast that with the construction industry. If somebody turned around and said, you know, from now on, we need you to deliver X number of pallets a week instead of what you normally do. Got options. I start looking around for other, sites that, and I probably might say, well, maybe you need to go and talk to somebody else, because I'm not going to do that. I mean, it does depend. I'm not saying it's a complete no, but there's more negotiating power. The other piece that's different about the construction industry is fee distribution. So it's all right for a client to say that by implementing BIM, we will realize a saving on average of, 10% on our projects, because we're going to see the conflicts between the different disciplines, services, structure, and whatever else, fire. And we're going to resolve them in the design before we even get to site. And we're going to make that saving. But each one of those parties who are kind of working together on the design is saying, well, but that reward that you're getting at the end of the project of saving of 10%, we're not seeing that. So what's the incentive for us to do all this work and save? So until, and I think this is what clients are realizing, and certainly, Dr. David Mosey has put together a procurement approach called the gold standard.
Yeah.
And it's more now about partnering and alliancing. It's trying to get rid of that race to the bottom where, and it comes down to actually very basic things. If all of our project procurement criteria is, I'm just throwing out some numbers here, 70% cost, and then 30% technical quality and so on, chances are the cost is just going to be the main driver. Until we change that, mix of criteria, it's not going to change, because there are going to be very talented and resourceful suppliers, contractors, subcontractors, who won't get a look in, because in spite of all of the expertise they have, it is just about the number at the end of the day, and that overrides everything else. And until that culture changes, and I think it's a lot of it has to do with horizons of view. So if you're in the project mode, your horizon is, the 7 years or it could be less, 3 years. And therefore, everything is driven by those types of costs. They're not driven by the life cycle cost of the building. And until you have a soft landings approach where the longer term stakeholders, the operational people, have a greater say in decisions about and choices that are made on the project, it will be simply a case of how can I get the best number, the lowest number, and hopefully get this over the line within the time available. Until you've got stakeholders who sit outside of that horizon saying, hold on a second, what's the whole life cost of this? What's the impact on longer term impact on sustainability? What's the longer term impact on occupant comfort. So you start to do things like, you know, post-occupancy evaluations, which then say, okay, yes, you delivered the building within the cost envelope, but also you delivered end-user satisfaction as well. It's those things that need to have a greater play and a greater influence on the project delivery team. Otherwise, it comes back to the statement or the saying that's attributed to Einstein that, you know, the very definition of madness is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Yeah. Well,
yeah. You know. Yes, absolutely. So we're nearly at the end of 2022. How far, and I'm just thinking now, how many years? It must be, just 2022. So was it 15 or 16 was a Pharma report, right? When we had all this diagnostics of how terrible the industry is, or was, or is, or whatever. We can debate that. But, I mean, have we, you know, and one of the key things of that Pharma report was, like, you know, digitalization and collaboration and all that. But, you know, have we really come on with digitalization in the way we should? And are we creating the right culture in the industry for a meaningful transformation? You know, where digital technology is playing that key role in sorting out these systemic problems that need to be urgently addressed.
I think we're starting to make inroads into different forms of procurement. And I think at the time when, for instance, the government construction strategy first mentioned BIM, which was back in 2011, people didn't realize how much the procurement route would affect the use of these digital tools and the use of innovation in order to prove outcomes. But I think now people are seeing, yes, if we have a different approach to procurement, if we are, for instance, things like integrated project insurance, or even alliancing, there's a greater chance of people not only adopting these tools, but actually getting the benefit out of them. So that's part of it. Bottom line, more people are using shared repositories for data. And very often, people just aren't realizing that reduction in transaction costs, that they are simply, for instance, I mean, they're putting stuff into a Dropbox and then sending somebody a link. Whereas before they would have sent an email and then they'd be scratching their heads and trying to work. When people are working on a document, they're using Office 365. They don't realize that they can just right click and go through the version history and sort of see the version of the document that they sent to somebody, you know, 3 weeks ago.
Yes.
Those kinds of things are there. And I think we're just not realizing how the way we do work has changed since we use these kinds of online tools that automatically capture all the changes that are being made over time. And we can always go back through the history. I think that is happening and has happened and has reaped, delivered great benefit. I think the challenge has been that the overall vision and the pervasiveness of this technology through the industry and through that hasn't happened as yet. And a lot of that, as I said, has come down to the same things. People are saying, I don't have deep pockets. I'm on tight margins. How can you even expect me to start doing this type of thing? And I think being able to change the narrative that we're sharing, which is claw back time first. Don't just jump feet first into new tech. Clawback time with things that make you just your data to improve your day-to-day efficiency is going to be the first chance that you get to have some breathing space to start thinking about how you do this. And I think if we take that approach, there's going to be great likelihood of success than compared to what we did before in terms of everybody getting this and using it instead of just the tier ones and tier twos. Yeah.
Brilliant. Right. And then as we head into 2023 then, what technology do you think will play a significant role in construction? And what are your own aspirations for the year ahead, personally, and for the Houses of Parliament project that you're involved with?
So I think, because I suppose it's also one of my, you know, focuses around safety, I think AI is going to where, for instance, you've got tools that can, for instance, identify that somebody's not wearing PPE during a concrete pour, that they're working at height, but they haven't got a fall arrest system in place. I think that those kinds of things are going to, because they are low effort, I think those kinds of things are going to become more prevalent in terms of, you know, the, it can just capture a photo and it can extract that kind of, you know, insight from that kind of image. That's going to be more prevalent. And it probably means for safer sites. For me, you know, being able to provide an environment which allows people to make, and I'm talking about lay people, not the technical people who are working on the project, but the lay people, MPs, those kinds of people. And I say lay because they're not necessarily technically literate when it comes to buildings. For those people to really grasp the principle behind a particular design approach or construction approach, if they can see a picture that paints a thousand words and say, I absolutely get that, then for me, that would be, even to be able to get that sort of feedback from stakeholders by the end of 2023 would be a massive leap from where we are today. And then in terms of my own kind of journey with software development, I think I'd like to, for a number of housing associations, to see the tools that I've developed and to be able to say, this could be a way that we can avoid another Grenfell, and to then give that a chance. I think that would be really positive to see that somebody is using it, they're capturing all this fire safety data, and it doesn't necessarily have to be many of them, it just needs to be a few who are actually implementing it and get some value out of it. And of course, the longer term value is, you know, for the people who are residents of those buildings and know that there's a clear audit trail on the decisions that were made and the kind of cladding that was put into, or whatever other materials were put into that building. Yeah.
Dave, I wish you every success for next year. And thank you so much today for your time. I know you're a very, very busy person, and it's been great to talk to you today. Thank you very much.
Well, brilliant. And thank you again. And, you know, I really hope maybe in the not too distant future, we can do this again.
Oh, I'd love to, Dave. Love to do that. Thanks a million.
Cheers. All the best.